stars flicker. And in ways I'm not going to try to explain because the expert who can is sitting here in the studio with me, that flickering can be heard and the sound lets us see into the star. Now, I reckon 2 out of 10 is about the best I can hope for that explanation of astroseismology, the field pioneered by my guest, Dr. Connie Arts from the University of Leuven, who is in Australia to deliver the Stibbs Lecture at Sydney University. And her subject is Deciphering the Music of the Stars, Asteroseismology. Connie, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thanks a lot for having me. It's a great pleasure.
What do you reckon? 2 out of 10?
No, that's okay. A bit more.
A bit more than 2 out of 10?
Yeah.
Okay, so let's have your explanation of what asteroseismology is.
Yeah, so asteroseismology comes from Greek, actually. Aster, which means star. Seismos means quakes. And then logos means doing a reasoning. So we actually unravel the star quakes, if you like. Oscillations of stars, and then we make a mathematical model of that and interpret that in terms of physics.
And you turn it into sound.
Well, you see, the stars have oscillations, which makes their gas go up and down, and that creates waves, because stars are actually hot, gaseous balls of fire, right? And if you put them up and down a little bit, then you create sound waves, just like we're doing right now in this studio.
Well, let's do, right now in this studio, the sound waves of a mighty red star.
I agree. That's one of my favorite stars. It's a huge, big star. It's a cosmic bass.
A cosmic bass.
Yes, that's how I call it.
Right. But we also have, courtesy of your work, the sound of the sun.
Correct.
Let's hear the sound of the sun. That sounds a bit sort of tinny.
It's disappointing, right? After
yes.
The cosmic bath. Yeah, why is that? The sounds are according to higher frequencies, right? Because the sun is a much smaller star than Xi Hydrae, the red giant that you heard. So the bigger the musical instrument, the lower the frequencies. You know, you have piccolo musical instruments and you have bass musical instruments. And it's exactly the same in stars. For me, stars are just three-dimensional musical instruments.
What's new about this, Connie? I mean, Pythagoras talked about the music of the spheres at about 500 BC. You're just talking about the same thing.
Nah, not really, because he was talking about sound created by motions of heavenly bodies. And we're actually in astroseismology talking about sounds that stay inside a star. We can't actually hear it. So to make it clear, the sounds that you just played are actually transferred to the audible regime of human beings, right? So we kind of like cheated a little bit in the sense that we put the frequencies at much higher frequency than they actually are, given that the sound stays inside the star. It can't travel to us, you know, because sound cannot travel in empty space. So we kind of have to help humans to hear the sounds. We call that sonification, right? And so here you heard two sonifications of sound waves inside a big star and inside a very small star,
okay,
which is the sun. For us, the sun is just a very tiny star, you know.
Not much to worry about, the sun.
Not much to worry about, indeed, yeah.
Okay, now let's take us on the next step. How sound can let us see into the star.
Yeah, so these sound waves actually travel completely through the star. For me, the stars are musical cavities, just like in a concert hall, right? And so the way that the sound is heard is actually telling us something about the situation in the concert hall, right? The density, the temperature, and the pressure. That sets the frequency of the sound waves that can travel there. And so by I mean, sonification, if you like, so you can hear it. But us astroseismologists, we do it by mathematical analysis. We can couple the frequencies of the sound to the temperature inside the star and mainly the density inside the star. And that's actually the only way for us to probe directly the interiors of stars, because we only see the light of the star from the outside surface, actually, and stars are tiny little dots. So by measuring these frequencies, we can actually say what the density inside the star is, and we can say how old the star is. And so that's a new method. It's now about 2 decades old, and we could detect these oscillations in the light of the star by flickering light, only since about 2 decades, thanks to space missions that operate above the Earth atmosphere, you know. And so that technology progress made this field boost. Because humans say, like, the stars, they twinkle, right?
Yes, they twinkle.
They twinkle. But that's not the stellar oscillations that we are measuring. Because
that's atmosphere, isn't
that
it?
That is not the stars themselves. That's just the atmosphere of the Earth that disturbs the light that has traveled so long to reach us, and then the Earth atmosphere sort of blocks it because it's not fully transparent. So when human eyes see stars flickering, that's not the tiny little vibrations that I am after, which go as 1/1,000,000. So that's so small, tiny, tiny changes in the brightness of the star due to the vibrations. I mean, 1 in 1,000,000 is, you can't capture that with a human eye. So the sun is doing solar quakes always, it's doing that right now.
Shaken by earthquakes.
Yeah, but it's so tiny. It's so tiny that you can't detect it unless you have a very sensible instrument that can see these tiny vibrations.
I'm going to make a stab at another metaphor. Is this a bit like looking at a baby in the womb using sound waves?
Sure.
To give us a picture?
Yes, exactly. So ultrasound, you know, allows you to see inside the human body. And so that has, of course, fantastic medical applications, right?
But what do you find inside stars?
Well, what I was after mainly, I study big stars, you know, much more massive and bigger than the sun.
You say that in a way of saying, I'm not going to waste my time with the stars.
What do they call you?
The mother of...
Yeah. The founding mother of astroseismology of massive stars. But anyway...
Yes, massive stars. They're your field, massive stars.
Yeah. Actually, the experts here in Sydney that I'm visiting right now, they are expert in solar type stars.
Just little ones.
Little ones.
Yeah.
So they already do that. So I can better do something else. Yeah? And what's specific about massive stars is, so it's a hot ball of fire. They rotate fast, right? And if material rotates fast, then it mixes better. I always compare that with people who like drinking coffee with milk, you know? What do? You pour your milk into the coffee jug, and you're not going to wait, because by the time that the milk and the coffee are mixed, it's cold. It's no longer fun. So what do people do? You take a spoon and you stir. Now, in my language, that is giving angular momentum to the coffee. And then it mixes immediately. Now, in a star, it's exactly the same, except it's not a fluid, it's a gas. And so the more your rotation is active, the more you mix. And if you mix more material, then the star lives longer. So that's a neat way to deduce how long the star will live before it explodes in case of a massive star.
So. And is this what we're most concerned about with the stars of the universe, when they're going to explode?
Yeah, that's an interesting phenomenon, because if a star explodes, then it gives all the materials that it made throughout its life, it gives it back to the universe. And so for me, massive stars are metal factories in the universe, actually, because they are nuclear reactors, if you like. And so they are very big champions in creating nuclear energy in a good way. Yeah? And so they make all the materials. I always tell people, if you touch your body, touch your hair, touch your jewelry, everything is made by the stars. So we should be grateful. But how much material is made by the stars depends on our computations of stellar models. And so to improve those, we need to know how stars rotate in their interior. And that's really my thing.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Connie Arts, pioneer of the field of astroseismology, here in Sydney to deliver a big lecture at the University of Sydney. Connie, how did you decide that you were going to devote your life to stars?
Well, I lived far in the countryside, and as a little girl, there was not much to do. I come from a worker's family, so education or culture wasn't really a topic of my early life. And so I had only time to watch the stars. There was no street lights, and it was fantastic. And so it triggered my curiosity. It was pure curiosity as a little girl. So I thought, like, oh, that's wonderful. So when I went to primary school, I was in a boys' school, by the way, so I tend to be an outlier. Yeah? I just happened to end up in a boys' school. And so the director had sort of spotted my talent for calculus and asked me, what do we want to become later? And I said, well, it doesn't matter because I will not be allowed to study. So he said, well, tell me anyway. So I said, if I really could choose, I want to become an astronomer.
How old were you at this point?
I was 11.
Oh. Yes, right.
And so he took that up. And
he took you seriously?
He literally drove to my parents and told my mother, just let her do her thing, just let her study and send her to the university, even though there is nobody in your family doing that, because in that way she can become a mathematics teacher. And so my parents had a whole other future for me, but we made a plan together before he went, saying like, okay, let's try this. Let's convince them that a mathematics teacher is an acceptable profession.
Steady work.
And you keep the astronomy as a secret. And so that's what I did, actually. Yeah.
When did your parents finally twig to the fact that you were going off into this strange field?
Well, that was when I graduated as an undergraduate in mathematics. So I decided to start a PhD in astrophysics. For that, I had to go to another university in another part of the country. And so at that point, I told them like, oh, I'm going to start a PhD. But I didn't even stress the astronomy at that point because I was still doing teaching assistants in mathematics also at that university. So for them, I just was doing the teaching in mathematics as I promised to deliver, which wasn't a lie, but it was sort of like circumventing reality a little bit.
I'm going to remember that formula for the rest of my life. Not a lie, but circumventing reality a little bit.
Yes.
When did you and how did you twig to the notion that you could penetrate the stars by measuring the oscillations of their surfaces and turning them into music, of course? When did it come to you?
Well, in my PhD, I made some mathematical predictions, if you like. Huh? We didn't have observations that could really help us deduce that rotation inside the stars that I really wanted to get at. So that my eureka moment, as I call it, happened in 2003, because there was one big blue star that I had been following my whole PhD and doing observations from ground-based telescopes in Chile in the Atacama Desert, because we didn't have space missions at that time. And so my supervisor already had started with that star, but he had given up on the star because it was too complicated. I was too stubborn and I continued observing it. So at a certain point, I had a data set of 21 years. And there I finally managed to deduce six frequencies, six different sound waves. And that allowed me actually to deduce as a primer in a star other than the sun, the internal rotation frequency of the star. So that's, more than 20 years ago. And then I knew like, okay, now we have it for one star. We knew that space missions were being built. And I knew already this is going to be a flood of data where we can do similar stuff. And that happened actually.
Once the telescopes get out of the Earth's atmosphere, or once observation gets out of the Earth's atmosphere, is that why everything changed?
Yes, because It took me 21 years of measurements to derive 6 frequencies in that particular blue massive stars. And then you get satellite data that are never interrupted because day and night doesn't exist outside of the Earth, right? And so it's the fact that we were able to measure with a factor 1,000 better and without stopping the observations that changed everything. And so we theoreticians knew this was going to happen, but we just didn't have the data yet. And so then all of a sudden, yeah, we had data of thousands of stars. And then we are still working on the initial data from the Kepler satellite from NASA. That's actually the best measurements we have so far. And we're still working on it on a daily basis because there's still so much to discover in these data.
Have you given up on the blue star?
No, I'm not giving up on the blue star. Stars never let me down. So this blue star is something that I love. And the result, by the way, of 2003, the result still stands. And it still keeps me busy to understand it better.
So nothing discovered since has put it in doubt.
Correct. Isn't that lovely?
Broad smile on Connie's face, ladies and gentlemen. So what else does seeing into the interior of a star tell us? Yes, how long the star will live before it explodes, but what else?
Yeah, there is a very intriguing fact that we don't understand very well, which is very important in astrophysics, that the more massive a star is, the higher the probability that it lives together with a twin, right? We call these binary stars, right? And so what we have yet to develop much better is what I call tidal astroseismology. Yeah. So because if you have two stars revolving around each other, it creates tides, just like the Earth-Moon system, right? We know that tides are important for our lives here. Right? And so tides are also very important for binary stars. And oscillations of binary stars are being discovered in the data since a decade now, but the mathematics of it to model them and to interpret them is much more difficult. So that's something we're working on. And another thing is that if you have two stars and they pull and they rotate, then they're also deformed. Because the Earth is also deformed in the sense that the radius at the equator and the radius at the pole are not equal. So we say that stars are flattened.
We're a bit squashed.
Yeah. And so developing the mathematics of astroseismology of deformed stars is still in its infancy. And that's quite hard mathematically, but I'm a mathematician by training, so I love that aspect. And so I'm going to spend my last 10 years of my career doing that.
You look as though you've got a few more years than 10, but Connie, how do stars deform? What shape do they have when they are deformed?
Well, they in mathematical terms, we say a flattened spheroid. You could compare it with a baseball, if you like, right?
Yeah.
So, or with an American football shape. So it's much smaller at the poles than at the equator. So it's elongated.
Ah, right. So it deforms in the same way that the Earth deforms.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, only much stronger because the rotation of these massive stars is massively faster, you could say.
Do they become sort of a disk?
Well, almost. That's a bit much.
Yeah.
It's a bit, it's not really a disk pancake-like, but it's more of a really deformed sphere, you could say, right? And so we don't understand very well how that works. And of course, if you have these sound waves traveling inside a perfect sphere or inside a flattened sphere, it's different frequencies. The frequencies don't behave exactly the same. And we have yet to develop mathematical models for that.
The massive red star we heard before, it sounds like music. It really does sound like music. Perhaps we could use it.
Oh, yes, it has been used in Belgian discos. You know, when we made that sound clip by the European Southern Observatory, that was, I think, 2002. And, you know, I give quite some public talks, so I introduced it. And at one point, there was a DJ in the audience, and he asked me if he could use it in his discos. I said, of course, you know, open data. Scientists of the universe give their data freely back to the taxpayer. So it was quite popular at some points in discos. So if people, sometimes I get the question like, why do we need all these expensive machines and why do we have to invest in you know, blue sky research? application.
In a disco.
In a disco.
Connie, thank you for joining us on Late Night Live.
Great pleasure.
I've been speaking to Professor Connie Arts, pioneer of the field, no, not pioneer, the mother of astroseismology here in Australia to deliver a huge lecture at the University of Sydney. Hey, Connie, let's go out on the music of the Red Star again. I just want to hear it again.
Yes, good idea.